Welcome to For the Love of Conversation, the podcast that grew out of 3 Minute Storyteller, where we believe conversations connect us and social change begins with the stories we tell. At 3 Minute Storyteller, we share digital stories, video snippets of intimate, messy, expansive conversations with a wildly eclectic bunch of artists, scientists, leaders of all stripes, all who are legendary change agents. Some you may know, and hopefully many you don't. This podcast is the opportunity to bring you into the full conversation. I'm Shannon Mannon, along with my husband Mike and our VW bus Scarlett, who we've outfitted into an awesome mobile storytelling unit. We invite you into the full conversation with us. We're so glad you're along for the ride. The coronavirus hit the pause button on our busy lives, and it's now time to rethink some of that chaos. Celeste Headley, this week's storyteller, speaks to us from America's biggest stages and through our dials on National Public Radio, and most recently through her best-selling books. Her most recent book is Do Nothing: How to Break Away from Overworking, Overdoing, and Underliving. It explores our obsession with work and productivity, and helps us understand the value of doing less. Celeste is calling us into a better relationship with our progress, so as we evolve in so many marvelous ways, we take advantage of our innate gifts and wiring as human beings, and release the habits we cling to that are doing us harm. In this conversation, we talk about how humans are designed to work together and collaborate, and how better conversations and better listening can help us find our way back to each other. So thank you so much, Celeste, for taking the time to sit with me here.
It's a pleasure.
Such a pleasure. So I want to just dive right in. So you've said that fear holds us back from engaging in conversation. Can you talk about that? What is it that we fear?
You know, it's really interesting because it's basically trying to answer a question that doesn't make sense. Because conversation is really good for us, physically, emotionally, neurologically. It's what we humans do better than anything else. So why are we avoiding it, right? And we've started to get this inkling that, in fact, we're so much inside our heads. When you're talking to someone, you're sitting there worrying about whether what you just said was funny, whether you sounded stupid, whether you said something racist or sexist. You have this whole inner dialogue going on, and you miss all the social signals they're giving you that demonstrate that they're enjoying talking with you, that they're making eye contact and taking turns and enjoying the conversation. And so what it ends up meaning is that people like you more than you think. Those fears that so many of us have that a conversation is going to go badly are almost entirely unfounded. There's also this fear that we seem to have about how a conversation will end, how we're going to get out of it. And so I have actually found that by just simply having people practice having really short conversations with your grocery store clerk, with the barista, and then learning that you can quite easily get out of a conversation just by going, "It's been nice to see you. Bye-bye." It's really easy, right? And then you can allay people's fears.
And you found that those small talk kinds of conversations that you mentioned are actually really healthy for us.
Really good for you. In fact, they found that if you have a 10-minute conversation, even with a stranger, about nothing important, it actually, you'll perform better on a whole range of cognitive tests. So there's, I mean, first of all, a conversation, neurologically speaking, is difficult. Right, it requires a great deal of focus and it requires energy. And so it focuses your brain and gets your brains working in a way that then is gonna help you with inspiration, with creative problem solving, just in terms of your accuracy. After you've had a short conversation, you're more accurate, less likely to make mistakes. So yeah, it's very good for you.
And we don't think about the health benefits of that's not something anyone talks about or you study it, but
yeah. And they're beginning to study it more because we have a crisis of loneliness right now. And people don't seem to realize that loneliness won't kill you directly, But it will lead to all kinds of things that will kill you. Loneliness degrades your internal organs. People who have strong social groups are way more likely to survive cancer. Their wounds heal more quickly. They did a long longitudinal study in the UK, I think, in which they found that after following a group of men for a period of time, they could predict based on how many significant social interactions they had, they could predict who would still be alive in 10 years. So yes, go out and have those conversations about nothing, about someone's tattoo, about the bus they like to ride, or maybe they don't like the bus. I don't care what the subject is. Go out and have those conversations because they are so good for you.
And you talk about two different kinds of conversations, many, but two specifically, the small talk one, which we talked a little bit about. And then there's another kind of conversation, which you alluded to in your first answer, which is these conversations across difference, where we're nervous that we're going to say the wrong thing, or we're scared to talk with somebody, or maybe we think we have nothing
in common
with someone.
Which is ludicrous, right? Of course you have things in common with people. Obviously, everyone who's on this planet at this moment in time where we're all dealing with global warming and all dealing with the same world leaders and all seeing trailers for essentially many of the same movies, we have things in common. But yes, these longer conversations that are difficult, they've kind of separated listening into three basic types. There's evaluative listening, there's interpretive listening, and there's transformative listening. So the kind of listening you don't want to be engaged in is evaluative. And that means that at every moment, you're constantly judging whether the other person is right or wrong, whether you agree with them, whether you don't. That's the kind of conversations we often have with people who disagree with us. Do I think they're right? And that's what you're listening for. You can't both listen for that and actually really hear what they're saying. So you really should at least engage in interpretive listening. Interpretive listening is where you're trying to understand. You're not endorsing, you're not agreeing with them or disagreeing, you're just trying to understand what the other person is saying. The deepest kind of listening, of course, is transformative, and that means that you're actually in a space in which you're willing to change your mind. You're open enough that you're willing to be transformed by what you hear. Not every conversation you have is going to be transformative. It's not expected to be. But at least you can be an interpretive listener for those conversations about maybe sticky subjects. And rather than worrying about arguing with them, debating them, whether you agree with them or not, set that all aside and just try to understand.
And there is that implicit sense, I feel like, that folks might have, that if I'm listening to someone who's wearing a hat with a slogan that I might disagree with, or in some other way I've decided that they are the other, I am endorsing them, or I'm somehow putting my values aside. And you're saying that we can listen for a different purpose.
Yeah, I mean, I've often asked people, what is it you're giving them by listening? What benefit are they taking away? Because there isn't one. And by creating an empathic bond, which is the kind of bond that you can create with true listening, that's the only thing that we've found that will reliably change anybody's mind. That's what actually changes people, is an empathic bond. What changes them is never the statistics you have at your disposal, or how strong your argument is made, or what your mom said about it. None of that is going to change anybody's mind. But by creating an actual bond with another human being, where you both recognize each other as human beings who are for whom life is also difficult, because nobody gets away with scot-free, who have had to make choices that you may not agree with, but that's the best they could do. Once you begin to humanize one another, then it's way more easy to kind of see where they're coming from and accept that their decisions are based on a different experience than your own.
And you told that story in your book about the African-American woman who sat down with the Grand Marshal.
Zernona Clayton.
Yes,
Zernona Clayton
was
in charge of the neighborhood project in Atlanta, and the mayor had come and warned her, by the way, one of your neighborhood captains that you have to work with is a grand dragon in the KKK. Zernona is still black. and he's deceased now, but I think based on his interviews and things, I think he first came into her office not just to report back, but also to argue with her. I mean, I got this sense that he kind of wanted to mix it up with her. But she was such a good listener that he just kept coming back. And at one point she said to him, why do you keep coming back to here? And he's like, you're just so easy to talk to. You know, and then he held a press conference and said, I'm leaving the KKK, and it's not because of Martin Luther King's death. It's not because of any of this other stuff. It's because of this little 5-foot brown-skinned woman, and she's one of the best women I've ever met, and I can't hate her.
Oh, I know. I mean, that is it.
I know. There's a street named after her in Atlanta.
Mm. And you talk a lot about our empathy deficit, how it's eroded, mm-hmm. And we don't quite yet know why.
Yeah.
Can you talk about how you see, you know, so we're a little fearful of conversation. Conversation's really good for us, and it's really good for social change and building these. So what's the disconnect? Why are we not doing these
things? I wish I knew that. Yeah. We don't entirely know, right? I mean, a lot of people are about to say that it's technology's fault. And blame it on the smartphone or on social media. But, you know, my next book, I did a lot of research, and it is not the fault mm-hmm. of our technology. Technology makes it way easier to avoid other people and remain isolated. But it didn't start with technology. It started decades before the smartphone ever came out. I mean, you got to remember, the iPhone came out in 2007, I think. We were already pretty far along this path of social isolation and distancing ourselves, to the extent even that now the ratio of home size to lot size has majorly decreased, meaning that we are making our inside world bigger and really decreasing the amount of outside space in our homes. We're not going outside, right? So putting away your technology, and this is what the new book is about, because I was like, okay, well, let me test it. I'm going to get rid of my electronics for like a month. Nope, did not work. So we have to step beyond that and actually look to our habits and how we're seeing other people, and whether or not we're overloaded with contacts, whether or not we are trying to spread our social energy over 1,000 people on Facebook instead of really investing in those friends who live right next door and that you can see day to day or play a board game with or whatever it may be. We sort of laugh at earlier generations who were in the Lions Club or bowling leagues and we're like, oh, how quaint that they used to have neighborhood barbecues, but in fact, that made them healthier. And those are the things we kind of need to get back to doing.
Well, I think you've talked about this. We, as Americans, we really value this narrative of this. We are a hyper-individualistic nation. We value the narrative of the bootstrapping cowboy that can pull himself up and only needs themselves. And that is fine, and there's a lot of power to that narrative, but it has to work in creative tension with the community side of it. And it feels like we've just gone so far off to one side, and that the community side has really weakened and eroded. So I see your work and the work of conversation and conversation and community as somehow bringing that it's giving us something tangible to do that we all can do.
And that's what we're good at. That's how human beings succeed. It's interestingly enough, in the research for this next book, I looked up the origins of bootstrapping. So bootstrapping, lifting yourself up by your own bootstraps, the earliest uses of that phrase was meant as an insult. Mm-hmm. Like, it was so ridiculous that they would insult people, like going, he's going to lift himself up by his own bootstraps.
Ridiculous.
Ha, ha, ha. Right? Ridiculous. And then we turned this into this, like, lift yourself up. It's not real. You can't do that. And that's why it was supposed to be a hilarious joke. Right? That's how stupid the myth of the self-made man is.
And so how, in your new book, so you started studying efficiency. Mm-hmm. Like we're obsessing about our productivity and our efficiency for what? So tell me a little bit about...
Right, for what? That's the essential question, right? I mean, some people will do tweaks. They'll sit there and they'll read Harvard Business Review or something, and they'll have one of those articles of, here's the 5 things successful people do. And they're like, okay, I'm going to do those 5 things. I'm going to get up at 5 o'clock every single morning and make my bed and, you know, eat a muesli or whatever it is. But are you stopping to wonder why? Right? Are you evaluating any of those things to say what is this actually improving? Because is your life like Jeff Bezos's? Why, are you adopting habits that work great for a multi-cajillion billionaire that do not work for you? You know, like, you have to, we keep doing these things that we think are saving us time and making us better, but we're doing them blindly.
Right.
You know, without any concern over whether they actually fit us and our personality and whether they work for us. And another myth that I really wanted to break down in this book is this myth that hard work is all you need. Right? And we hear this everywhere. You work hard and you're going to get it. Nope. Absolutely not true. Mm-hmm. We have this mythos, and it's particularly bad in the United States, but it's not just us. Some of the worst nations for this particular toxic view of work and viewing any kind of idleness as laziness and sinful. Yes, it's particularly bad in the US, but also in Canada and the UK and Australia, and even in a lot of parts of the developing world, China and India, and even in parts of Europe as well. It's a global problem with not allowing people to ever relax, even though the human brain does not just keep pushing. That's not how the brain works. The human brain pulses. Effort and relax. Effort and relax. That is how we work best.
You said something in an interview once. It was a quote from somebody else. That's, we can't spend all of our time becoming. When are we going to just be?
Be, yeah.
And I feel like that's what you're getting at, this drive to production, this drive, we've lost the essence of who we are. So in your research, what have you, in exploring this,
you know,
what have you found as an anecdote to some of this?
So it feels like this is, we can't change it, right?
It
does. It feels like this is the way the world
right.
is. But that's one of the things that, you know, having the time to research this book made me realize, this only started like 250 years ago. It's a blink in the long stare of evolution. For most of our history, we were task-based and we were seasonally based. Medieval peasants got half the year off, mm-hmm. right? So it has not been very long since we started doing this pattern of behavior, which is so toxic and destructive, which means we can get back.
Okay.
We can get back to regular human strengths and community and a hive mind, which works so beautifully for the Homo sapiens. We can reclaim our humanity.
And can you talk about our human, you say it so beautifully, just about how we are evolved to be communicators and collaborators. And I feel like that is at the heart. I think that where that neuroscience and that evolutionary science that you've connected, all of it, it's truly our birthright. And if we're not using it effectively, communicating and collaborating, then we're missing, we're trying to have technology replace things that no other species is really that good at.
Exactly.
So,
for a very long time, we tried to tell ourselves that the reason we had come to dominate the planet is because we're smarter than everybody, right? Well, that just may not be true, right? It turns out humans aren't particularly logical thinkers.
Right.
We are very illogical. We're the only species that is prone to confirmation bias. We're emotional. We're extremely easily manipulated. So once that was debunked, we had to then go back and figure out how that happened, that we actually came to be so successful, even in light of our competition with other human species like Neanderthal. And it turns out it is because we're so good at working together. It's because if I go to a doctor, I don't just have to go, I can say it hurts right here. It's like a stabbing pain, and it's right here between my two ribs. I can communicate exactly. We were also able to trade with one another. I don't just have to hold out some bowls I made. I can say, I made these clay bowls. I'll trade them for your jerky, whatever it may be. It also means if we need to take down a creature which is way more impressive than us, which is almost every creature, we can work together, right? We lose to mosquitoes. I mean, come on. So we can work together and do that. And so this one thing that we do better than any other creature. And this is another thing that I've written about, is the way even our biology adapted and evolved in order for it to get us to speak. For us to be able to articulate words, our mouths got bigger and more flexible, our mouth moved back, but importantly, our larynx had to move down our throat in order for us to articulate words. If you look at a gorilla, they're up higher, or a chimp. Which means there's no chance in a gorilla that the food will go down the wrong way, right? Because the larynx is right up here. That's one of the reasons they can't speak. In a human being, because the larynx moved out of the way, it's possible food can go down your windpipe and you choke. Which means literally we risk death in order to speak to each other. And that's what we're trying to replace with emojis. I mean, come on.
And I feel like, you know, one of the things that we recognize, like we have these, you know, you hear the cliche a lot, you know, we have two ears and one mouth.
Yeah,
we should be exactly. Listening more.
Yeah.
And we're evolved. We've gone through all this human danger to talk. So we really want to talk.
Yes.
Maybe that's why we want to do it so much. It feels so good.
It does feel good.
But, you know, and you say listening is really hard. Like it truly is. And we don't really talk about that a lot.
Isn't that weird how we give public speaking courses but no public listening courses? Because the speaking we're fine at from birth, if you've been near to baby, yeah, they're good screamers. But listening is difficult for our species. And again, this research goes back to the 1950s and 60s. It's not because of technology. We struggle to really listen. We struggle to stay focused. And then we really struggle to retain what we've just heard. Right? We lose 50% of it immediately. Yeah. Immediately. So, but there are ways to strengthen your listening skills. And part of them have to do with mindfulness. Part of them have to do with just learning how to listen in a different way for different words, for meaning instead of actual language, those kind of things. But we don't teach anybody how to do that. And then also we give all these inspirational speech. We're like, go out and listen to people and it'll be so engaging and energizing. But they're not gonna leave that room. They may feel inspired, but they're not gonna leave that room being better listeners. Mm. And that can be very deflating when you find out that you're struggling to do what it is that you think you're supposed to be doing. So yeah, we need to be a little easier on ourselves and understand that listening is hard. If you're not able to stay in a conversation and focus, then you need to step away and you need to acknowledge it to yourself rather than pretending you're listening and wasting their time and your own time. Mm-hmm. Just say, give me an hour. I am struggling to focus with you right now. There's too much going on. Let me do a brain dump and let's come back to this when I can hear you. Keep your conversation short. If you're an introvert, start with those conversations that are with like the grocery store clerk because they're only going to be 2 minutes long. You know it. And they're paid to be nice to you. So make it easy on yourself and start slow. But do try to focus on listening to at least one person really carefully every day.
And it really is a muscle.
It has to be an exercise, yeah.
Yeah.
And a discipline.
Which is no fun.
It's not, except then your brain is going to be flooded with serotonin and possibly oxytocin. Those are the feel-good hormones. You're going to feel great. Your cortisol level is going to come down. Your heart rate will come down. If you do it regularly, you're less likely to have a fatal cardiac event. You're less likely to develop diabetes. For example, if you're friendly with your neighbors, you're way less likely to get burglarized. I mean, the benefits in the end are massive, even though it is tough to make yourself do it every day. It's like going to the gym.
If we're telling people, you know, to go out and engage with folks who, you know, start small. Like I hear you saying, first step, start small. Ideally, we can build up to having more challenging conversations.
Yeah.
And really trying to hold, you know, one of the things I think that really struck me in your writing, and I think you called it conversational narcissism.
I did it. Charles Derber, the sociologist, called it that. Yeah.
That has really stuck with me. That can you describe what that means?
So Charles Derber used to write a lot about shift versus support responses. So if you were to say, "Hey, I have to do this interview today," and I would say, "Oh my God, me too. I've got like four interviews." I've just shifted, right? As opposed to you saying, hey, I have to do this interview today, and me going, oh, who you're interviewing, which is a support response. Conversational narcissism is this tendency to turn conversations toward ourselves and what we know and what we've experienced. That comes not just from ego. Sometimes it just comes from the fact that yourself is the subject you know best. So you turn it back to yourself. Maybe there's times when you're like, I don't know what to say. So you go back to familiarity, right? But if you were like me, once you learn about this and you start actually paying attention to how often you shift versus how often you support, I started realizing I was shifting all the time. That's when it becomes conversational narcissism. And that's a really scary name for just basically someone who ends up talking about themselves a lot. You know, and we do it without thinking. And I get it. Harvard found that talking about yourself activates the same pleasure center in your brain as sex and heroin. It is extremely pleasurable. It feels great. That good feeling, though, is usually not shared with the other person. That's usually just you feeling good.
So good.
I know. So good. So, yeah.
You're so right, because after hearing about that, I really analyzed, because it does feel so empathetic in the moment. I feel your pain. Yeah. I'm with you. And boom, back to me.
Back to me.
We're all here to listen to.
I know,
really.
Exactly.
Well, it's the same thing with listening, because we all feel like we're a good listener. I do a lot of conversation work in my community and engaging people to come together and have conversations. And through a lot of different modalities. And I get so much, I'm a good listener. You know, it's really more the other guy you need to talk to. So I feel like this is a thing too where, and I know I think I'm a good listener. You know, I think maybe we all do. Is there anyone that says, I think I'm not very good at listening?
There are a few people.
There's a few of God.
But I will say that when conversations go wrong, something like 70 to 80% of people say it was the other person. There's only two people in this conversation, so the math doesn't work, right? Usually blame is shared, and we don't like to share the blame. But that's because we have our version of a story. We think of disagreements as a way to just convince them to agree with us. Even if we won't admit that, that's what they are. So of course it's the other person. They won't agree with us, right? Of course they're not listening, because if they were listening, they would agree with us, right? And when you realize that your story is not the same as their story, and I say all the time, if you and another person go to a parade, you will have come away having seen a different parade, right? You'll have all spotted different stuff in there. And this is the same thing as your stories about what you think is factual isn't. It's just the part that you saw. Mm-hmm. And so you need to establish your story and then let them establish their story, letting it support back and forth, back and forth. And then you'll sort of arrive at some kind of common ground of, oh, I didn't realize. Mm-hmm. So yeah, of course everyone thinks they're a good listener. Of course, mm-hmm. Yeah. What's the quote from when Harry Met Sally? Everyone thinks they're funny and have good taste, but of course we can't all be funny and have good taste.
Look at the man in the mirror.
Right? Exactly.
you're in this work of retelling, and I feel like, you know, when you talked to Gloria Steinem not too long ago on the podcast, and you know, she had a quote about we're not destined to relive. If we can find evidence that we lived a different way, we can make it happen again.
Yes.
I'm really butchering that, so if you remember the better way to say it, please correct me. But that was the essence. Like, you're going back and you're finding that we had other ways.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's basically what I've done in the new book also. And it regardless of who's doing it, I'm not going to compare me to Gloria Steinem, but I will suffer by that comparison. But regardless of who is doing that, it's always powerful to remember, to be reminded that this is a new normal, that this hasn't been the way it was always done. What you think it's always been done this way because it's been 10 years? Pfft, 10 years is nothing. It's nothing. And so we can return to other ways. We did have better ways of doing things. And maybe the past can't inform the future. I mean, we have all these quotes about it where they say those who don't know the past are doomed to repeat it, and yet you also have another quote that says history will teach us nothing. It's because we don't learn from history. It teaches us nothing because we don't learn from it. Mm-hmm. And so therefore we're doomed to repeat it.
And when you, so you're, and you're not saying, you know, the bygone era, let's go back, you know.
No, of course not.
It's taking what we have learned and applying it. So it's really, one, let me pause, because you talk about time a lot, and I feel like you have a generational view of time, a much longer time sense.
You're calling me old.
I mean, if Gloria Steinem wasn't going to work, then I'll just try this. Like it's a, but it takes that longer view of, a more expansive view of time than maybe we're accustomed to thinking about.
Yeah, I mean, I think we are so overloaded and so overwhelmed that all we can do is put on our blinders and just keep moving ahead, right? That's part of this whole push behind hacking, right? Hack your brain, hack your daily habits, hack your diet, whatever it may be. It's just like incremental, this tiny little change might help me. And what I want to do is just let's step back, lie in your hammock for a moment. Let's take a breath and actually look back. And one of the ways that I arrived at the new book was, I was actually thinking about my grandmother and all the things that she did. I mean, she was part of this is actually my great-grandmother, now that I think of it. She was part of a Lotus Club, and she did Shakespearean plays to raise money to open a library, and she had the Scarab Club, and she was in the National Association of Colored Women, and a founding member of the NAACP. And all of a sudden I thought to myself, wait a second. She was also a full-time teacher, and for a big part of her adult life, a single parent in 1895. How did she have the time? Because she didn't have a refrigerator or a washing machine. And then I went around my house and I started adding up the minutes I save every week because of my microwave and my smartphone and my Roomba, my robot vacuum and my dishwasher. And I added them up and it came out to hours, like over 20 hours a week that I have extra than my great-grandmother did. And I was like, so where is that time going, right? And that ended up being a 70,000 word answer, so I'm not gonna give it to you now. But that's sort of the thing of like, we're not talking about going back to a bygone era. I'm talking about wondering, have we progressed in the right way? You know, did we get off the path at some point and go a little bit too far to the right, and we need to sort of right the ship and come back to learn the things from the past that we should have in order to progress in a healthy way. You know, Noam Chomsky says that it's uncertain at this point whether the human species is a viable species. He's talking about climate change, but I also think it's partly because we're self-destructive. Mm-hmm. We're kind of self-destructive. Mm-hmm. So maybe we can pull things back into line to a way and a pace that is more human and more healthy and takes advantage of our natural gifts.
I hope you enjoyed this conversation with journalist, author, and speaker, Celeste Headlee. To learn more about her, be sure to read her books, We Need to Talk, How to Have Conversations That Matter, and her latest, Do Nothing, How to Break Away from Overworking, Overdoing, and Underliving. You can follow Celeste on Twitter, at Celeste Headlee. Also, remember to subscribe to our mailing list so you never miss a story from us. You can find the link at our website, 3ms.co. That's the number 3, the letters ms.co. And be sure to follow us on social media at 3-Minute Storyteller. As always, thank you so much for being part of the conversation.